All right, this is Nancy Campbell and Joe Spillane interviewing Anna Rose Childress.
Childress, yeah.
On June 20th, 2006. And if you would, Anna Rose, could you start with telling us something about the pathway that you took into addiction research?
Sure. I came in through essentially a back or a side door. I guess it's fair to say my graduate work at the time of my thesis was looking at brain substrates of reward and pleasure. So I was actually trying to find out where is pleasure in the brain and where is positive incentive motivation in the brain. I'd been very impressed. One of the first demonstrations that you see in psychology classes is animals that are frantically pressing for electrical stimulation of their brains. It's everyone's Psych 101 experiment. And in graduate school, we used to demonstrate this to the undergraduates at Bryn Mawr, and they were impressed. I was too. It was so impressive. And knowing that those animals would do that to the exclusion of almost everything else was really interesting to me, because it was a frenetic pursuit of reward, and that was really interesting. So I did that kind of work in my thesis with little rats, to whom I became very, very, very allergic, and also became very allergic to the intermittency of results. You know, you'd be working with the animals for a long time, and then you would have results, and then you'd work with animals for a long time for another little batch of results. And so when I got to the end of the thesis work and had been trying to plot where in the brain might be the substrates for reward that was related to catecholamines, and where might it be related to what was hot at the time, the endorphins, and we were using different kinds of blockers for those sites that were supporting self-stimulation reward. And I was very allergic to rats, and my mentor, who was Larry Stein, who was extremely inspirational and informative in my appreciation for reward substrates and pursuit of them, said, well, you know, I don't know, what do you want to do now? Because he was thinking he was going to go to the West Coast.
He went to Irvine.
Right. He had been at Wyeth Labs for more than two decades, and he would usually choose a student or so at a time to come and do work in his lab and let them do their thesis in his lab at the same time.
So your thesis was done at Bryn Mawr?
With Larry Stein at Wyeth.
Awesome.
So he was an adjunct professor at Wyeth and at Penn, and offered me the opportunity, he knew my enthusiasms, and offered me the opportunity to come and work in his lab at Wyeth. And so that was a wonderful experience, because you're there in a professional lab and they're, you know, churning through lots of rats. That means you get a lot of exposure. That means you do get allergic, typically. So I was thinking, well, I'm really interested in reward and pleasure, and I'm really interested in understanding about the brain, but I would really like something where I have more of a sort of day-to-day sense of the phenomena. You know, I'm trying to model here, modeling things to death. Because prior to reward, I had been on the flip side, on the dark side, I had been working in my first couple of years of graduate school with models of avoidance and models of learned helplessness. And that was abysmally depressing. So I was interested in the brain substrates of essentially mood and motivation. So I'd started on the dark side. Mm-hmm. That was miserable. Mm-hmm. And getting exposure to Larry, thought, well, reward and pleasure, that seems like so much more fun. That just seems really, really interesting and appealing, because so much of human motivation is, you know, what do we pursue? We're defined by what we desire and what we pursue. So I thought, what do I do now? And he said he had heard of a postdoctoral experience at Penn, where they took into the Department of Psychiatry an odd group of psychologists, people who were not clinical psychologists really. Mm-hmm. They were people actually who could have experimental degrees or an interest, as I had, in sort of physiological psychopharmacology, who had never touched a patient, and who would get mentored in learning about human psychopathology and disorders, including those involving reward and such, like depression. And it sounded wonderful, and you would take the third and fourth year of a psychiatry residency as a postdoc. So you sort of slide in with the people that have already completed medical school and have done their first 2 years of residency. And as a PhD, they decide if you can be turned loose on patients and how that will go. Well, it turned out to go really well. I really enjoyed immediately interacting with the patients, and I was not allergic to them. And they were interesting, and we got the broad range of disorders walking in the door. So, yes, you saw mood disorders. You saw mania. people frantically pursuing, you know, things that were pleasurable. And you also saw depression, and you saw schizophrenia. We saw the whole gamut. Mm. And as a little project within that 2 years, I was trying to see if I could block alcohol-based euphoria in Penn undergraduate drinkers by giving them a dose of naloxone, an opiate blocker. One of the things that was ambient at the time was the hypothesis that at least part of alcohol reward was opiate-mediated, and that if you could block it, mm-hmm. you might be able to block it. So I had no trouble recruiting Penn undergraduates to drink alcohol. And thanks to Chuck O'Brien, I had no trouble with the supply of naloxone. In fact, mm-hmm. he was kind enough to supply me and kept supplying me at no cost because it was a really small grant.
So that's how you met Chuck?
So that's how I met Chuck. So mm-hmm. as I got to the end of that period, and he said, well, Anna Rose, what are you going to do? Would you, you know, like a position here? Because he knew me a little bit by that time. He knew mm-hmm. my interests, and he had an opening in his lab. He had just had funded a large grant. It was a 5-year grant to understand better patients' responses to cues that signaled the arrival of drug. And at that time, it was opiate patients that was based in opiate patients. And he knew my peculiar background, which was that I had a strong background in learning theory because of where I was at Bryn Mawr and experimental psychology design. And as it happened, I had this interesting overlay with a human experience and interacting with patients. So, and that I had the interest in the opiate blockers. So it worked out that basically I came in and sort of started running that project.
So let me ask
you, sure.
before that time,
sure.
had you known,
even before,
yes,
even before graduate school,
yeah, had you ever known anybody who was addicted, or had you any prior experience?
It's interesting. Well, in the mountains where I grew up in Appalachia, where, you know, mental health care is still limited and was extremely limited at the time. So one of the things is I always try to sort of myself look back and understand something about the things that fascinated me or scared me as a child. I had favorite aunts who were, as it turns out, they were bipolar. And they were favorites because when they were hypomanic, they were the best playmates. They were the people who would play endlessly with the kids. They would go out and dress up on Halloween. They would have endless energy. They would be the people that were always baking. They were always doing. And so I had them on both sides of my family. My family is just loaded with affective disorder. And they were my favorites. And then it was really disturbing to me when at times more than one of them would go into what was clearly a dark place and, mm-hmm. and even be tearful and withdrawn. And at times they were hospitalized. And this was really well before lithium at that time. It was really, especially in Appalachia, as well before lithium.
And where was this?
Well, when I say Appalachia, it's really for me, it was the very, very far, far southwest corner of Virginia, right before you fall over into Kentucky. Mm-hmm. So Virginia's mm-hmm. sort of like a big triangle, and if mm-hmm. you go way, yeah. way down, very remote. So this is about 4.5 hours southwest of Roanoke, which is the last right. city that anyone remembers before you keep going far southwest. So it's pretty far southwest. So for me, it was disturbing to see people go from feeling so good mm-hmm. and being my favorites to seeming like they were in pain and with nothing that I could observe that was an external trigger for this. And I would say, well, Mom, what's, you know, Mother, what's wrong? Why is Aunt Nina Mae crying? Did she hurt her arm? What's going on? And she said, well, you know, she has a sickness, honey. She's sick. Well, they didn't really have exactly an understanding, but they knew the cycle of these aunts on both sides, that they would go through periods of feeling and running in fifth gear or sixth gear, and that the bottom would fall out. And it would usually be the depression that would actually get mm-hmm. them into the hospital, not the manic side. So I don't know where that was necessarily in the mm-hmm. back of my head in any explicit way, but I was really interested in brain and behavior even before there were scanners available and even before it was fashionable, because
right.
you know, at that point, I was interested in psychology. I was interested in motivation and why people do and feel the way they do.
Right. How'd you get to Bryn Mawr?
So I was at Virginia Tech, which was one of the two schools I applied to when I applied to colleges. And I applied to my mother's alma mater. She was from a generation where it was very rare for people to go to college mm-hmm. in Appalachia. She was from a family of 11. Both my parents were. And 11 that grew to adulthood. And she had managed, because her aunt had a little tiny country store, to go to college at a place called Berea College in Kentucky, where you work your way through. And it's an opportunity for mountain kids who have no other real good options to get an education. So the fact that she had done that set the stage for everything about my life, my sister's life, and everything to probably be different than a lot of people around us, because books were there from the beginning. Yeah. She loved literature. She loved learning. And it was a microclimate for me of having an enriched environment in a place that was, you know, not really focused on getting kids into school at that time. Mm-hmm. Some people went on, and increasingly people went on to school as I became college age. But when I was little, it wasn't like there were a lot of other models around. So I went to Virginia Tech. It was a state school, and it was inexpensive, and it was large, and it seemed to have a lot of offerings. And it was, and because both my parents were working, I couldn't qualify for Berea. She really thought that was the best experience in the whole world, and she really would have liked me to have done that. But they were both employed, and so you know, I missed the cutoff for being desperately financially needy. Though we didn't have money, it was still, you know, that's really reserved for kids who truly don't have any other good options. So I went to Virginia Tech, and it was a large school with a psychology department that was sort of in the throes of radical behaviorism at the time. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of quaint, and it's a bit of an aside, but basically, I remember coming home from freshman year from the Psych 101 there and telling my mother that said, you know, schizophrenia, you can use a token economy and change the behaviors. You know, I never really thought about schizophrenia as just being like towel hoarding behavior, and that if you could make it go away with tokens, but it seems like you, and I was trying to process this because it didn't exactly map on to how I thought about the psychopathology. It seemed that there was a lot else going on with schizophrenics, but this was a sort of extremely behavioristic department where the idea of psychopathology and brain wasn't really ambient at the time. It wasn't really where you looked. Yeah, there was a brain, and it was there. You know, it could be there to support electrodes, and it could be there to do other things. But if you were talking about pathology, and even their abnormal psychology course was really, it was run by their sort of behavior modification guy who would talk about how you could modify behaviors. So nothing wrong with having a good, you know, operational definition of things and learning about contingencies and all of that. When it came time to apply to graduate school, each one of my professors looked at me as a blank slate. I'd done well in all the courses and projected onto me what they thought that they would like to do now. And and I applied to several graduate schools, and Bryn Mawr was one of them, and Bryn Mawr had a strong learning program, a strong physiological psych program, and it had the neuropsychopharmacology piece with Larry Stein. At that time, though, I chose based on strength of program and also someplace that I could be financially independent without having to burden my parents. So I was accepted a half a dozen places, and Bryn Mawr had the best package, and they had a strong program. So that's how I came to Bryn Mawr, and it was a rarefied environment, very much sort of, you know, with a strong focus on learning theory and physiological psych, and with Larry as a breath of exhilarating air in terms of reward.
Yeah. So tell us more about Larry.
So Larry Stein is, if you've met him maybe, he's a big thinker guy and always a broad brush guy. And one of the things that was wonderful as a graduate student was to see him be able to, in a very inspiring way, be able to make contact between animal data, you know, looking at transmitters and their function and what would be going on with this or that pharmacologic manipulation, and disorders. So Larry had, you know, the norepinephrine deficit hypothesis of schizophrenia before dopamine was on the ascent. I can still remember he was very enamored of norepinephrine, and that was really where he came into the picture, and he was basically doing lots of really interesting pharmacologic experiments and blocking norepinephrine. He could block self-esteem, he could do lots of things to block that system that would impact what looked like rewarded behaviors. And when he gave our first class, it was just the feeling was of doors opening, because he wasn't just talking about paradigms, but it was paradigms translational before it was even a word, right? Mm-hmm. In which he was basically making contact between what was happening with these animals, with this blocker, you know, blocking brain self-stimulation reward, and schizophrenia. And, you know, it was tremendously appealing for me because it really opened up all the levels. Mm-hmm. And I'd sort of had this interest in the clinical psychopathology for a long time, but and the towel hoarding days and the token economy days, there wasn't really much place for it. And even at Bryn Mawr generally, it was a pretty it's an interesting environment. They at the time had divorced from the clinical department long before, which was sort of the developmental department. And there was a rift, and they didn't really talk much to each other. And so the people who were in the experimental program were over here and were doing noble things. Over here was the sort of soft clinical work, and it was someone like Larry who could make a contact between a rigorous paradigm and having it inform potentially very important disorders that were absolutely clinical. So, at any rate, so he was the one who told me about the Penn program, and so I came in through the back door. Rather than coming in, frankly, to study addiction, I was coming in to understand how the brain manages mood and motivation, really.
And so what did you know about addiction when you entered
so
that?
So I had not had any special training in addiction. I mean, heaven knows in Appalachia there were plenty of people who had alcohol problems, and especially there I'd seen people who clearly undiagnosed depression, could be self-medication, could be anything, but alcohol was the main drug available there. But I wasn't really starting the work with Chuck O'Brien with the idea, oh my gosh, I've got to find a cure for alcoholism. I was really interested in sort of reward and understanding about how that plays out. And of course, addiction is a perfect forum in which to look at how a disorder of the pursuit of reward, you know, evolves, what happens. And so at the time, I was interested in understanding about these cues, which were immediately, clearly, obviously powerful. And you would see, I remember the first heroin patients that I would talk to and ask them to give me accounts of their craving episodes. This was a way of learning. And it was really striking because you could, and I had read the Wickler articles, and I read the Chuck O'Brien articles.
Did he tell you to read the Wickler articles?
Oh, sure. Yeah, part of my immediate introduction there was to sort of read up on essentially what was at that point a real focus on the conditioned withdrawal side of the coin, because in some ways it was shaped by the patients that were there, right? So just as Wickler had mostly worked with opiate patients and had noticed this really colorful set of responses that would occur when people start talking about their drug use, the things that were very noticeable to the patients and to an observer are things that look like opiate withdrawal. So people, you know, yawn, sniff, tear, complain of feeling nausea, they may have even chills, and so the really salient things are very much withdrawal-like. In talking with those early heroin patients, it was also true that some of them were also able to describe, and we were able to characterize this, things that were not withdrawal-like. They were clearly drug-like, and so they would talk about having a heat flash or feeling that their eyes were heavy-lidded when they were talking about an episode or when they were fondling the paraphernalia. And so it was clear pretty early on that there was more than one kind of learned response. Mm-hmm. Also not too surprising, if you think about the situation, sort of the same cues are around if you're a heroin patient who's at the end of a cycle and you're in withdrawal and you're getting ready to use the next amount of drug. There are the cues, there's the paraphernalia, you're beginning to prepare an injection, and all of those cues have the opportunity to become associated with that pharmacologic state, which is withdrawal-like, but they're also present 15 seconds later when the drug hits your brain to be associated with the extreme drug-like effects, and also 15, 30 seconds after that with the euphoria extending. So in humans, these things tend to overlap. The same set of cues could and would pull out drug opposite, we'll call them, kinds of responses, and drug-like kinds of responses, each reflecting some of the pharmacology of the drug. So we began to characterize those and then to begin to think about drawing on the learning background, the conditioning background that I had, and the conditioning background that Chuck and Dr. Wickler had an interest in. Strategies. How would you go about trying to help patients manage these symptoms? What could you do to reduce them? So the very simple things that we did. Should we do that now?
Yeah.
I mean, you just want to flow that way?
Yeah.
Sure.
That's fine. Okay. So the very simple things that we began with were paradigms that were based on basic old Pavlovian extinction. So just as with Pavlov's dogs and the meat powder, if you pair the tone with the meat powder, after a while the tone elicits salivation. But if you omit the meat powder, after a while the tone, or your can opener for your cat, if you never follow it by tuna, will be less evocative, right? So that you could, in theory, present a lot of these cues over and over and over again without any heroin following them, and maybe that would reduce their impact. Because certainly you could show that you can do extinction in animals.
And did you go off and read Pavlov also?
Oh, sure.
He got you to do that. And
well, it would be part of what you needed to do to have some understanding of this. And we all, you know, people had read some Pavlov in graduate school, because remember, I came from a learning theory graduate school. So I had done that before getting to
right.
Chuck.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I had a reverence for Pavlovian conditioning.
Right. He went off to visit Pavlov's lab.
Yeah, I didn't. I was not in that generation. But you know, I had a reverence for Pavlovian conditioning and the fact that things become associated and things become linked, and that forge can be quick. And before coming to Chuck, so that's why it was a very natural and comfortable dynamic. He was interested in its application in this venue. I was really comfortable with the fact that that's such an important part of daily existence, is that you're responding to cues that have importance, and that's what guides us through our environment, be it importance in terms of things that are dangerous, or be it importance in terms of things that are positive that guide you back. So we began to think about extinction paradigms, simple extinction paradigms. What about having people handle paraphernalia, do sham cookups, show them videos? We did versions of all these over and over and over again, not followed by drug. And maybe if we could get enough cues, a broad enough cut on the cues, that after we gave people that kind of experience, it would reduce their reactivity to those things when they encountered them on the outside. So we could show that you could get some reduction in reactivity when you did that. In the context of either my clinic or in my lab, you basically could show some reduction in these symptoms. They were persistent, though. It was impressive how persistent they were. But there would be some reduction. But the tricky thing was, and this was true as we began the cooking work, which comes right on the tail of this, that basically it's very hard to get all cues in the door and simulate them properly. Some of them are highly individualized. But the trickier problem, and it became clear after working with the patients for a while, well, patients are cognitive creatures, right? They can form and do form a discrimination. Anna Rosa's videotapes and paraphernalia will never be followed by heroin. However, those around the corner are still very good, reliable predictors of heroin, you know? And so, essentially, in part what we were doing, it wasn't the plan, but we were conducting a very elaborate discrimination mm-hmm. paradigm, mm-hmm. where basically we did produce reductions in arousal and responses to our cues to some extent. It was never complete, by the way. It was interesting how entrenched these things were, but it was also quite clear that it was not completely transferring or generalizing to all the things out there around the corner.
Right.
And why should it? Right? Because it would be like, okay, here I am in this place with you and your clipboard, and okay, you know, still somewhat evocative, but oh, she's never going to follow up with heroin. It's just never going to happen. And yet they go out, and yeah, mm-hmm. it is a discrimination. So in the beginning of the cocaine work, which hit Philadelphia, cocaine became cheap in Philadelphia in the early 80s. So even by 82, I came to the Addiction Research Center in 81 at the end of my two-year postdoc. Mm-hmm. So my postdoc was 79 to 81. And I came directly to Dr. Brine's lab in May of 81, 25 years ago. So so it was, when we began to work with the cocaine patients, the thought was, well, what do we do? You know, how do we have a better impact? And what can we do to get around this problem of lack of generalization and the fact that they form a discrimination? What can we do to blur the boundaries? What can we do to make it more realistic? Can we, you know, short of in vivo, because in Europe they've been able to do in vivo work because it's not such a violent drug scene, right? Mm-hmm. So just as you work with bridge phobics and you actually take them to a little tiny bridge and then a bigger bridge, you can do in vivo work with bridges and rubber snakes and things like that, but to do true in vivo work in Philadelphia with the heroin scene or the cocaine scene would be very life-threatening. all I have to do is walk out with my clipboard, you know, and we are in the middle of a very heavy drug-using area, and people would be very concerned that you were going to tell them that you were an agent, that somebody's going to, and it would be very dangerous. So there's no real good possibility to do escorted exposure work. Unescorted exposure work seemed to be ill-advised because people are often, as we can talk in a few minutes, quickly overwhelmed by these states, and it's hard for them to put on the brakes and try to dampen it down and pull their tools to the forefront. So what can we do? So our first outing with cocaine patients was still attempting to do some version of exposure, but we quickly migrated to what we called active strategies for combating craving. And so we went to a posture where instead of trying to simulate in the lab every possible cue, or even trying to individualize it more, or trying to make it even more realistic, and trying to blur the boundaries between our lab and what we tried to do was take a step back and say, okay, we want people to be essentially trained up in strategies that we think may be effective in helping them to inhibit their response to these cues whenever and wherever those cues arise. And recognizing that the cues themselves are going to have a lot of individual variability. By that time, we were very full aware that even though, certainly for a laboratory paradigm, if you get the paraphernalia, that's going to be very powerful because that's a very good predictor. But actually, stuff that's much earlier in the chain is really important in terms of getting the most likely success, right? Because once the train gets rolling down the tracks, snowball down the hill, whatever metaphor you want to use, by the time you get down to funneling paraphernalia, you know, at that point, are you going to say, oh, now let me employ my anti-craving tool? No, because at that point, even though that's great for demonstrating these cues' power, it's not the best point which you want to start your intervention. You really want to go really early. You really want to train people to look for the very earliest whiff of desire, the very earliest reminder of things starting to get off track before everything gets completely revved up and before every possible condition response is called out. You want to look early. And so that's an approach where you want to look actually very individually with people at their patterns. What is the earliest for you warning sign that things are beginning to get derailed? And now let's go through. And what we did was distill a package of strategies that was based on what our patients who had been successful in staying abstinent had told us was sometimes effective. And we had a lot of good clinical experience. By that time, I had several years of clinical experience, and my colleague, Dr. Anita Hole, who is the clinician with whom I've worked closely now for over two decades.
H-U-L-L?
H-O-L-E, Anita Hole. Okay. And she and I basically manualized a set of active strategies for coping with cue-induced craving. And so that was the thing that we did, and we started that at the end of the opiate work as we faded into the cocaine work. Mm-hmm. And it's really been the thing that we've built on. Mm-hmm. And these strategies are a series of things that are taught essentially as a group of tools. They can be done on an inpatient basis. They can be done outpatient as well. And they involve a person coming in and with the clinician telling about an episode of craving, individualized
and
for them.
And how do you get them to tell that story?
By the way, tell me about how it's been this week, and have you had an episode of craving this week that's prompted you? Most people have. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't, let's go back to one that you recently remember. And it really is that straightforward. So you rate the craving when they come in, you have them talk about an episode of craving, and then together we're going to do the tool of the day here. So let's talk about, and we would use, and I can give you examples of some of those, but for example, for our patients, when they begin to talk about an episode of craving, they begin to feel a little bit of feeling, and that's intentional. So there's an exposure element to here. But we're not depending on exposure alone, not followed by drug, to carry the day. What we're trying to do is, in the context of them having this re-experiencing, they're going to have a different experience, which is to be taught a strategy for reducing it actively, so that they're given something that they can do out there, whenever and wherever. It's not dependent on which cue, it's dependent on them recognizing at the earliest possible time that they're beginning to get a thought, a feeling, a sensation that signals for them that they're beginning to sort of go along the path. And that's pretty individualized. Some people will talk about the fact that they start having payday thoughts on Wednesday night. Like they start having thoughts of, wow, it's Friday, you know, gosh, well, I don't need all of it for rent. Maybe I could just put it, and to start recognize sort of and throw up flags and to begin to then address those thoughts. And so with them, we teach them a group of strategies. I don't think we should go through all of them here, but I can give you an example if you like.
Would be good. I'm actually pretty interested in how you came to them rather than what they now are. But how you?
Well, how we came to them was actually a lot of good talking to patients about two things. First, we wanted to understand the circumstances of relapse, so we talked a lot about that. Mm-hmm. And we knew, as I just began to describe, that while for a few people they described this odd experience of, I don't know how I just got there, and suddenly there was a crack pipe in my hand. You know, sometimes they do. They really sort of can't label and can't really initially, at least, trace back and understand that there was a chain of events. Mm-hmm. But for most people, what we had always done in good therapy with them mm-hmm. was try to help them understand that this is usually not just an instant magical experience where I'm there and how did I get, that there often is an early warning sign, signals that they could attend to. So on the one hand, we had the experience of patients' descriptions knowing that there was often a long chain of events, sometimes short, but often long, and that it was the longer the better in terms of essentially protecting them. And that was important. The other thing we did is talk to people who had had any period of abstinence at all, that they had been successful for some period of time, whether it was a month, whether it was a year, or sometimes longer, and asked them, literally, the strategies that they had used. Mm-hmm. And so people would talk about, and some of these are very basic and they're common sense, but we literally wanted to formalize them and essentially teach them to patients. And some of them have later now become sort of mainstream as part of the relapse prevention literature, recognizing that if you have a feeling of craving, that you can sometimes distract yourself, so that if you can actually, at that time, that you begin to feel a little bit of craving, have an alternative activity or a plan B that you can go to, that you can essentially ride that craving out and distract yourself, and that when you check back 5 minutes later or after the activity, lo and behold, this particular craving may not still be there in the same intensity. By the way, as an aside, all kinds of different craving intensities, episodes, and durations can be described by patients. So sometimes mm-hmm. we'll describe something that is only 5 minutes long mm-hmm. and that is quite surfable and that they can come back down. For other people, they can describe something that's building slowly from Monday through Friday, up to, you know, simmering up to, you know, sort of a volcanic explosion on Friday night. Different kinds of subjective experiences. So one tool would not fit all. But for a potentially short-lived craving, something like distraction with an alternative behavior, we call this delay. Promise yourself that you're just not going to act on anything for the next 5 minutes. And what's your plan B? Which, by the way, important for that plan B to be something that's highly engaging. So something that they could view as a treat or an activity that would engage them, really take their thoughts away from the drug in a powerful enough way. So delay plus alternatives, if you want to call it, is one of the strategies that we start with for brief kinds of cravings. But very important for people, that in fact is one of them. Another one, and I think it's the third tool in the group, is trying very hard, and this is before brain scanners, mm-hmm. but essentially it's trying to bring the patient's frontal lobes online and help them actually consider the potential consequences of acting on the craving, even in the heat of the moment. Now, this is something that we as human beings are less than perfect at, right? It's why chocolate in February is such a vulnerability for all of us. You know, it's a long time till swimsuit season, and the chocolate is here right now, and it looks very good. And so as human beings, generally, we have times that we fall down in what I'll call a limbic moment. And by that I mean that, and even our legal system recognizes it, right, that when you're in a state of passion, whether it's a romantic passion or anger, and in this case it would be drug-related passion, it's an interesting thing that happens. And clinically we could see it, and patients would talk about it all the time. It's like I lost my mind. I don't know what I was doing. I can't believe I went down the alley. I can't believe I stole from my grandmother. I can't believe... And it was almost as though they found themselves to be decorticate, right? That they were not really getting any help from up front. So we knew that clinically long before we could ever visualize it with the scanner. Everybody clinically sort of knows that to be a problem. Patients know it to be a problem. What to do about it? So in these early days, we were trying hard to have people do something very unusual, that during a moment of craving, they were going to try to, literally, pull their frontal lobes online. We didn't put it that way to them. We said, we're going to try to have you think about consequences in the moment. I know that's really hard to do. And they'd say, but you know, when I'm feeling like that, everything else goes out the back of my head. Before that, mm-hmm. I know I could lose my kids, my rent money, I could lose the house. But in that time, I just can't think of... We know it's really difficult, but we're actually going to write these down with you, literally, on a card. What, for you, are the three most negative consequences of acting on this craving, potentially losing? So it really varies a lot from individual to individual. You think everybody's going to put job, house, spouse first. Maybe not. For some people, for some men, it was like, I've lost 6 inches off my chest. I'm not a man like I used to be. Very individual things. But the idea was to have them literally in the presence of a therapist and in the moment of beginning to feel this craving, recount these and literally list them and go over them with a therapist and make them very vivid so that they could say, I could die if that was one that came to mind. I am going to lose my kids if I act on this craving. The last time I used, I lost my wife. And really something that's evocative for them, and it depends, that's why you need a skilled therapist initially to do this. Sure. They have to really know that the person's not just reciting something that doesn't really seem meaningful to them, but that is. And then you ask them to sit with those consequences in front of them. And you can sort of see the sort of thing going on with it. And re-rate the craving. Where are you now on that 0 to 9 scale? And people say, well, yeah, poof. And they find themselves going down in craving. And for some of them, it's actually the first time. Because when we start working with people, we always ask them, so tell me about the strategies that you use when you would like to, not act on the craving. And sometimes you go to, there's never been a time that when they've craved that they haven't used. And that's honest. And people will tell you, come in and say, crave but not used? And so, so there's been a time that maybe, that you had some craving. So we'll start with what you've used before because we're going to build on that. We're going to give you some tools. But what has anything worked for you well? And you have a large percentage of people that describe that since the beginning and crossing the threshold into addiction, that craving is synonymous with using. Mm-hmm. And the idea of even just dissociating is extremely novel for them, not only as an idea, but especially as an experience. So to sit there with a trained therapist, re-experience some of the craving, recount some of the top three consequences, and then find this state reducing under their own power, with some assistance, is powerful for them. So writing down the consequences is sort of a preliminary one, and then after that, it's a step for others to not to have to write them down, but use a very visceral image for you of what happens to you at the end of a binge. Oh, well, I'm in a hotel room without any food. I've been there for a week. I haven't showered. I smell. I have no money. I have no food. I know I can't go back to work. Okay, now hold that image for a moment. And now when you're in the state of craving, I want you to bring up your image of the most lowest moment for you in terms of your cocaine use. Hold that at the same time. And so the same thing happens. So that then they go, yeah, that's really good. And they find that the rosy glow really comes off, the craving comes down. Now, people are variable in their ability to do this. Well, of course they are, because some of them have tried to do it on their own, and it's not so easy. And many of them, even with the therapist, can do it in the presence of the therapist. But the trick always is, what happens when you go outside and now you're out there and the cues are out there, and can you then implement these strategies?
So this is what you developed in the 80s.
This manual was written at 1990, this active strategies manual.
All right. So
we spent about 5 years with variations on cue exposure, first with opiates, and we did a whole study with cocaine patients with regular old passive cue exposure, we'll call it. And we manualized that too, and NIDA has that manual, the passive passive cue exposure stuff before we moved to the active strategies.
Okay, so you did that first, the passive cue.
Sure, because that was basic old Pavlovian extinction.
Yeah. Right.
And it was you know, try the simple thing first, see if you can do exposure just like they do with the snakes and the elevators and the
Yep. So at that point, you say this is all obviously before PET, before scanners.
It was.
But you were trying to do some work with polygraphs.
We were measuring people. So one of the things that we were doing with the passive stuff and even after the active strategies had begun was to measure people's responses to cues prior to treatment and at various points during treatment. And part of that was a way of having some measure of the arousal that people described. It was just a way of objectifying. And you could show that people had an increase in their heart rate for opiates or for cocaine cues, and that they had a fall in galvanic skin resistance, that's a nice arousal measure, and peripheral skin temperature would drop. And it's interesting, in the opiate era, as an aside, we saw those as being drug opposite, because of course they were, because opiates warm you up, and the interesting thing is, when we moved to a different drug, you know, we were still seeing the same signs of sympathetic arousal, cool fingertips, reduced GSR. So it doesn't mean that they aren't necessarily consistent with being opiate opposite, but these were people who never used opiates.
Right.
they were sympathetic arousal response, basically. And then what they were accompanied by would be colored by your particular drug use history. So if you had used opiates, you might have some of these opiate opposite-like stuff, or the opiate plus-like stuff. You might feel a heat flash, you might feel heavy lids, you might then have a sequence of these things, which is a bit of a subtlety, but it looks like the positive stuff is quicker and earlier and comes first, and then it sort of evolves into the sort of more withdrawal-like thing. Anyway, and all the time people are showing the arousal thing. So the arousal stuff was stuff we were doing long before we got our hands on a scanner. And we were always in touch with, because of my background, always in touch with the animal literature, right? So that at the same time I was looking at all these responses and seeing the cues, evoke the responses, and seeing the people struggle with managing the responses, and seeing that despite our best training, a lot of people were still struggling on the outside, because they still were. And even though some were clearly benefiting, some were still clearly struggling. It was really an uphill battle to pull the frontal lobes into the situation. We didn't know at that point, in a concrete way, that for some people, the frontal lobes were not available to be pulled online in the same way as for other people. So we knew it was a struggle, and I was really curious about the neurochemistry because, of course, medications development was at that point really building up for, especially for cocaine in the mid-80s. It was, at that time, a national epidemic. And the sort of formative thing for me in terms of what I wanted to test first with brain imaging, if I could get my hands on a scanner, were animal data showing that animals, and these were Tony Phillips rats with microdialysis, that rats, in anticipation of a receptive female, these were male rats across the plexiglass, or cocaine, had little gushes in dopamine to cue signaling the availability of drug or sex reward. And that was in 1989 at a Maudsley conference in London. And it was beautiful data, and I thought, I could just get my hands on the technology to allow us to look at whether or not dopamine is released to cues. At least this would guide some rational medication development. Mostly people were sort of grabbing at anything. They were desperate to try every drug category to see if something would help. And the idea that dopamine would be involved is not in and of itself new. People knew that cocaine was working at the dopamine transporter from the mid-80s. And so it was something that was there and sort of gnawing at me. But in 1990, at the time we were making our active strategies manual, we didn't immediately have access to C11 raclopride, which is the paper that finally came out this past week. No, in 1990, the only game in town was, at our center, was a SPECT ligand, and it was a dopamine D2, D3 receptor ligand, and I was going to try to see if I could do a competition paradigm and show that the dopamine was released in response to cocaine cues. So that's the aside there, but that began That's how early that began, 1990. Mm-hmm. It's when I began to hope that I could do that and to explore what I might be able to do locally in terms of the tools for doing that. That study, with Nora's help, that study finally was completed and was published this week in the Journal of Neuroscience. So, but anyway, we can talk about it. But that, and she knew. I mean, she was supportive, and that's a whole other chapter. But she knew that we were trying, and that we were trying with this tracer that didn't have such good signal to noise ratio. It was IBZM. It was a SPECT ligand, and we were trying. We had a. I got my first imaging grant was for that. It was neuroligand imaging was what I started with. So I sort of backed into.
And that was not an IDA grant. That was not.
Oh, sure. It was not. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was not a grant. Yeah. It was in our. It was a program project in an iteration of our one of our center grants in, and I was the PI on that project in. I believe it was 92. Mm-hmm. It was funded, so it was 90. I began looking around. We did pilot data submitted in 91. It was funded in 92.
So in order to make the move to imaging, you had to do some retooling, right? I mean, you had
well,
to learn.
So, what happens when you've come from animals and you've got the clinical overlay and now you would like to become, you would like to go return to the brain and you would like to keep sort of these things talking to each other, right? So I had the clinical experience that showed these huge responses to cues. I knew people were struggling in terms of inhibiting them. Forget that for the moment. Could we at least show what was happening to the cues, had a neural substrate that we could then address with medication? Interestingly enough, yeah, you would think retool was like, I wasn't going to become at that point a nuclear medicine physician. I wasn't going to become a physicist. There was a lot of things I clearly wasn't going to become. I was already pretty busy. But what I did want to become was a clinical investigator using this as a tool. And so for me and for almost everybody else, except those people who are the physicist or the actual chemists or the modelers, you look for a team, a multidisciplinary
right.
translational team, so that you can actually learn and you read a lot. And I did. But it gives you very little preparation for the behind the scenes in terms of exactly how technical and exactly how many ways things can go awry. So you can't possibly imagine that. And you're trying to develop a language for talking with people that are, you know, designing molecules to be tracers and making sure they have a good profile. But you talk to them about cue-induced craving, and they go, that's mm-hmm. okay. So it's a very interesting sort of experience to try to do this. Well, we were fortunate in that since that this first outing was with Hank Kung at the University of Pennsylvania, who's a very prolific radiochemist and who was willing to try to work with us and also had in place some infrastructure for analyzing the data once it was collected. Because if I'd had to try to go looking outside for pieces of people and trying to put together that kind of team, it would be very, very difficult. But I was a clinical user, endpoint user. My role was to make sure, if I could, that I got reasonable patients that could tolerate this kind of aggravation, which included many minutes of exposure, right? So it was not just now 5-minute videos or 10-minute videos or a little fondling of paraphernalia. For these competition paradigms, we had to keep the stuff going for 60 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long time because of that. That was the pharmacokinetics of the tracer. That's a long time, whether you're seeing chocolate videos or sex videos or anything, to sort of be in this state, right, the whole time. So my role was to find patients who were good cravers because they had to be somebody who I thought could actually crave in a scanner with the help of our videos. And yeah. by that time, we had a decade of and experience in videos. Right?
I am just... You know, how do you get them to see? Do you project them? I mean, are they on mirrors?
So the videos, we've had a number of different things depending on what the setting is. So in PET, we had a screen that, mm-hmm. because of the way the PET camera annulus was, it was on the ceiling. And so people could literally lie back and look at an angle, and we had a screen, and it was projected from a projector, a TV projector, literally. People always wanted to borrow it for the Super Bowl. We never did, but it was one of those things that could actually fill a whole wall with an image, but you actually had it, and it projected the image on the screen. So they would lie, look like this. And I would have neutral videos, PBS nature videos, and rest period and neutral. And so I had an elaborated paradigm for SPECT and an elaborated paradigm eventually for PET that involved long videos. And with SPECT, it was really long, 60 minutes. With PET, it was 2 10-minute videos when we backed into... I mean, I could talk about how after the SPECT experiment didn't really seem to work, we basically did, you know, 10 controls and 10 patients twice. So it was 40 scans. It was a lot of data and a lot of effort.
Right.
And put a modeler to work on it, and the amount of IBCM binding looked exactly the same for the cocaine session as for the neutral session. I was thinking, wow, you know, because people were craving their brains out. This doesn't make sense unless, of course, dopamine's not involved at all, which is one possibility, but the animal data, a lot of animal data by that point, showing microdialysis, everybody. So I thought, well, this is really odd. I wonder if this is a sensitive paradigm. I wonder if this is a sensitive tracer. Turned out the both were true. It was not a particularly sensitive way to do it. It was the only tracer I had a choice of, but it had a signal-to-noise ratio of like only 2-1, which is really low for being able to sort of see signal against background. But worse than that, we were trying to displace bound tracer after it had reached full uptake and had saturated and stabilized out, like at the 60-minute point. We had to wait for IBCM to be taken up and then start the videos at the 60-minute point. Well, it's the physics of this are such that it's much harder to push somebody out of a concert seat once they've taken their seat than if you can get there first. That's really the deal. So the better way to do this, and it was interesting, we were inspired to do it the way we did it by amphetamine studies that Mark Lowell was doing at Yale, showing that with amphetamine you could produce IBCM competition after it was already uptaken, and you could push the tracer out of the receptor seat. But we couldn't. I thought, well, maybe, you know, amphetamine's really huge. It's obviously so much more dopamine, so maybe I'm just in the, you know, just in a wrong ballpark in terms of the amount. I can't compete. Turned out that they found, too, that that was a much, much harder way to assess endogenous dopamine release in competition than to start the stimulation and compete with uptake, compete for taking the seats,
yes,
as opposed to pushing people out of the seats after they've already been taken. So, even animal studies showed that later, after we finished the IBCM study. But by that time, I still had no access to I didn't have access to any other tracer. IBCM was kind of a low signal, and I thought, well, what can I do to understand about this circuitry? I'll come back to the neurochemistry, but can I at least understand where the action is? With these tracers, I'm only going to be able to see the stratum anyhow, because that's the only place where the dopamine receptors are dense enough to actually be able to visualize with a neuroligand tracer. And we know that things are happening, and that part of the brain is talking to other parts of the brain.
So
what about if I do some neuroanatomical imaging?
Right, so this is a shift to really looking at localization.
Right, anatomical as opposed to neuroligand imaging.
Did you...
Did I feel good about that?
Yeah.
It was a bit of a, oh shucks, you know, I can't ask what I consider to be the question that you would like to ask immediately, the neurochemistry, because, why? Because that has the most immediate implications for developing a medication. Right? Because even though anatomical studies are very important and can be done in a way that allows you to look at pharmacology and making the signature go away and such, and I've spent several years doing that now, I really craved to know about the neurochemistry. For one thing, the field was, you know, full of theories about what was going on in cocaine dependence. Was the system, it was a very basic question, was the system depleted of dopamine and just completely run down and didn't have enough, and you were seeing, you know, cessation phenomena, that was that too little dopamine? I was worried that with cues there was, at least relatively at that moment, too much. There was a blip that was problematic. So could you have it both ways? Is it, you know, could it be that there was a kind of a deprived, low, sluggish baseline because you'd sort of turned off the system by flooding the synapse over and over again, but now that you've stopped, the system hasn't re-regulated back up, it's not making its own yet, is that possible? But then you have blips on top of that with the cues? Yeah, well, that's possible. But what happened is you tended to have camps in the field at the time where people were talking either about too little dopamine or too much. And so I really wanted to ask that question about what was happening to cues to at least make the point that whatever the baseline state is, the increase that occurs to cues would be problematic, and if you want to address that part of the problem, you better do something that modulates dopamine, and that modulates it down rather than up.
Right.
That was where I was. So I had to sort of after the IBZM experience, I had to sort of think, well, okay, I don't have any tool right now in my hands. Nora did. She had C11 Rack Leprag, Nora Volkoff at Brookhaven. And it was a way of asking the dopamine question with some better signal-to-noise ratio. And she had developed a pretty good technique for starting the stimulation, whether it was drug or whatever, before the uptake of the tracer. So she was doing it in a potentially more sensitive way. So that technology was available at Brookhaven, but it wasn't really available in a ready way at Penn. What was available at that time was anatomical imaging using labeled water as an anatomical tracer.
Right.
A still PET, so it was quantitative. And I thought, okay, so it's at least quantitative. I can get an idea of where the action is. I may have to wait a bit on what the action is, but where it is important. And I can also do pharmacologic things on top of that to see if I erase part of that or reduce that signal. I can still do that. So that was our initial PET study and the one that was published in 1999, in which and it took a while to get it published. We were... again, it was another new technology, right? So we went from neuroligand imaging, which is one whole set of techniques and ways of analyzing data, now to 015 PET, different, and different physicists and different multidisciplinary team. But fortunately, in this case, I had a robust enough signal to our videos that we were able to show in the first outing. Took long enough because we had to get people who, you know, could line a scanner and blah, 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 all that stuff. But they had limbic activation to cocaine cues. And it was an important demonstration to essentially take this technology that we had been doing so long, the cue-induced craving paradigm, and be able to move it into, approaching the 21st century, move it into a setting where we could begin to ask about brain substrates.
So now...
I'll take a drink of water.
Yeah. Can you... Where'd you get the videos?
Excuse me?
Where did you get the videos?
Made them.
And
make all my own stimuli with my patient's help.
So can you tell us a little bit about that process of how
sure.
you go about it?
From the outset, and I guess it's implicit because I take it for granted. Yeah, so from the outset, from the earliest work with the heroin patients and with the beginning of the work with cocaine patients, our patients have always been our greatest collaborators. It's with them that we create the stimuli, and they often help us create the simulations. They act in the videos, and there's a very good reason for that. It's not just because it seems like a nice thing to do. They really know what it should look like. Mm-hmm. And unless you have an actor who also has a cocaine problem or heroin problem, the subtleties in the way that they handle the paraphernalia or what they attempt to simulate will not read right to an experienced user. Mm-hmm. So the only thing that would really read right to someone who has the problem is someone who is really doing it as though they've done it 1,000 times, so that it really looks extremely practiced and way overlearned and way reflect, and that they can literally talk as they're doing it. So the way that we would create videos, I knew that I did want them to be talking at the time because I wanted them to interact so that the viewer would have some opportunities to get the visual thing, but also patients always talk about how drug talk, hearing someone talk, tell their story, even at a self-help meeting or in therapy, is enough to get them going. So you know that the auditory cues can be important as well as the visual cues. So I had these videos usually involved at least two people, and we'd often begin with simulated buying and selling of the cocaine and progress with then that person or another person then in a situation of simulated administration. And they would be asked by me, I would sort of sketch out for them the sequence of events, but I would be importantly aware that they're not actors and that we would have to get this on the first take, basically, because even
so
if someone says really...
So you with the video camera?
Me with the video
camera.
Can I
see them when I come to photo?
Oh, yeah.
Can I see some of these
We've
videos?
Got different versions. We have versions that are the first ones, right? And then we got the second generation, and we're now at least on the third generation of the cocaine ones. Because at the time, there were no videos like that. I mean, now there's a great program on Sunday nights called Intervention, where they manage to get people
this
who
is
are...
This is HBO?
Where it's actually, I think it's Bravo. Or any, I don't get HBO, so it must be. And
then,
so they have, like right now, I'm getting ready to set up to do methamphetamine work because it's finally on the East Coast, and that's going to be the next tough problem, I think. But now there's material available with documentary people who have good lighting and everything, you know, basically with people, nice close-ups of people smoking. I'm thinking, oh my God, there was nothing like that available at the time. So never even crossed my mind there was no such possibility. And I also wanted to have the patients validating all the way. So we would create videos, and I would edit them and take out what looked like the most evocative pieces, and if we had to do a restart. But importantly, I had to choose patients who would be not only experienced but camera comfortable, way out to everybody in terms of their addiction. So it wasn't like they were going to go back and take a jog with the school board the next week and suddenly say, I'm sorry, I'd rather you not use my video anymore. You've been using it for 2 years, but I'm sorry. That research is done now, and you can't use it. That would just be a nightmare. So we had to make sure that people were comfortably out and that they were able to be talkative and not overdo it so it seemed like they're over the top, because some of our patients really like the attention. And so choosing somebody who seems reasonable and have them then talk in a way about, wow, this is pretty amazing, or last week that was really good stuff, and they talk in a mouth-watering way. It's not chocolate, but in an evocative way about the cocaine they had, or the cocaine they're going to have, or the cocaine they just sampled and they're going to have some more. And so I have the auditory thing going and the visual thing going. In our polygraph work, we also had those videos followed by people actually touching paraphernalia and things like that, and going through a simulated cook-up and actually smelling what would smell like actual cocaine.
In the lab.
Uh-huh. But once we got into the scanners, it was important for them to be still and not do the hand movement thing.
I was going to ask you that.
So we became very video-dependent in the scanning environment. And right. So I had to have videos that really were very visually evocative and auditorily evocative, because I didn't have the tactile thing anymore, and I couldn't really do smell as easily in the scanners either. In the spect work early on, we did hold the little vial up to their nose when they're in the middle of the spect, but all of that becomes less easy, certainly as you get into the fMRI environment. It's just so very video dependent.
Because fMRI, they have to be even stiller?
And it's even worse.
Do you have them do anything else? Do you have them do any tasks?
I can tell you a little bit about that. We do have, in our MRI era, which has been the last 5 years, it's been...
So we should do the PET stuff first.
Yeah. So the PET stuff really quickly is basically, it was the first for us signature of what craving looked like in the brain, cue-induced craving.
Why did you start using the word signature?
Yeah. Well, I was looking for what the interactive network picture, what the big picture was in terms of structures that were talking to each other. Even though most of the animal work was very, focused on nucleus accumbens, focused on ventral striatum, we all know that structure is talking to other places. And, you know, it would be important to know what was up. And in my PET study, this resolution at that very first 015 study was not such that my neuroanatomical region drawer felt comfortable drawing in the ventral stratum. And so we could see the amygdala was glowing and applauding, and we could see the anterior cingulate was up, and we could see that the orbital frontal cortex was up, but he didn't feel comfortable drawing in the ventral stratum. And in fact, the dorsal stratum in that early PET study was actually robustly low. It's interesting. So we had and that was something I didn't have predictions about, and actually is still an interesting side item, but a distraction for the moment. But we developed essentially a network picture of nodes in this mesocortic limbic dopamine system, and that was interesting. The things that popped up were all consistent with essentially the stop-off points, the terminal regions of the cells that grow and live in the VTA and ascend through the brain. And what was also wonderful about this was that there were a lot of other people who inspired to look at cue-induced craving, and as their findings began to come in, there was an amazing amount of convergence in terms of these limbic regions showing up. So that while not everyone would get every region, depending on their technology and depending on whether they used videos to evoke or how long they presented the stimuli or whether they used scripts, you know, different ways. So so you look to watch. Do we need to pause?
I'm acutely aware of a 4 o'clock
that's fine
appointment, but
okay. Where are we now?
We're at 3:10.
Are we really? Okay.
And so I'm wondering if we can
I'm ready to I can stop at any point.
No,
start
let's
at any point
let's
too.
Try to go to a 3:30.
Yeah, if we could.
That's fine. So I think that'll take you right up through the imaging. I can make that go to the present day.
You think so?
Yeah, and then you can fill in later. If you decide when you want to come visit, you want to fill in spots, that's another way
to
do it.
But I was suddenly, I was struck by the fact that you're working with this drawer. You call him a drawer?
Well, he was a physician and an investigator, but also was certified for essentially drawing regions of interest before voxel-based analysis packages were available. What people did was have MRIs, structural MRIs, and they would draw, based on atlases, a region of interest, and they would even draw several of them. And then you would have to have people who were validated, right, so that they were reliable region drawers, so that they drew them, and another person who was validated would draw them the same way. And it was a very sort of an attempt to make things be the same across, at least within a lab, if you were going to have one or two region drawers. But it was also a very tedious and painstaking and, you know, laborious process.
Also subjective.
To a degree subjective. They tried to make it objective by saying that if you draw it and I draw it, there's an agreement of like 0.98 or whatever in terms of the voxels that are taken. But it was before SPM. You know, this was pre-SPM, before the statistical parametric mapping packages that are now available that allow you to do voxel-based analyses. And for a long time, that was an interesting thing in the field where people were married to ROI and thought that it was only ROI. People with voxel-based analysis would gently point out, well, yeah, that's true, and it's true that's matched to the person's individual MRI, and you don't have the issues of normalization and blurring and blopping. But over here, you can now look at regions of activation that might cut across two boundaries, right? What if your activation's at the boundary of the amygdala hippocampus, but in fact it's not just amygdala, not just hippocampus, but what if it's on the boundary? And if you just looked at those two regions and averaged the activity there, it would be obscured. You know, it would be lost if it didn't really fall exactly and only within a region. So it was, both things were true. You know, the region of interest method was not as vulnerable to the vicissitudes of normalization and stretching and warping brains, and it has that level of sensitivity. On the other hand, it basically did involve subjectivity. You go through the literature and you wouldn't be sure that when people drew the regions they were drawing them exactly the same way, and you would always have this retreat. Of course, there are always... So the voxel-based analyses were an important advance that allowed people to at least begin to go across labs, and still there's many subtleties and ways that people use various pre-processing techniques and normalization techniques and smoothing techniques, and all of those things can make a great deal of difference in what really comes out in the wash, even with the voxel-based techniques. But at least they allow you to look everywhere in the brain, and you can describe a functional ROI, like what's activated as a region of interest, not just an anatomical one. Mm-hmm. Some papers still will do both, right? They'll say, here's our voxel-based analysis. Now, we'd like to see either take that functional ROI and compare it across, or looks like that's mostly amygdala. Let's just do an amygdala anatomical ROI on our data, not draw all those other regions like everybody used to draw every region, but just let's focus just on amygdala, for example. So we see both. Anyway, so we backed into PET 015. We saw what looked like a limbic signature. That was very encouraging to us, and we did PET 015 for the first set of studies. At that point, there was a change in the cameras, the PET cameras at the university. We were to get a new PET camera, and the cameras were down for what is always an agonizingly long time. In this case, it was over a year. And we had been toying with the idea, entertaining the idea, romancing the idea of starting functional MRI studies, knowing once again it was new technology and that we would have to have, you know, physicists and MRI that wouldn't talk to the physicists from PET, and it would be a whole new set of people, and we would be, you know, starting out again. So it was with some trepidation that we sort of stepped gingerly into the fMRI waters at first, because I knew I was not going to have any much translation or carryover from everything that we'd done about PET. We looked for a technique that was as similar to PET 015 at first as we could for our initial outing. That turned out to be something called perfusion fMRI. Mm-hmm. It is a technique that's not yet as widely available as regular old bold fMRI. As a quick aside, bold fMRI tends to use briefer stimuli and depends on the contrast between two alternating conditions and essentially a signal averaging to sort of let you know the difference between two things and gives you a signal difference. This technique, you can also do contrast, but it's quantitative and it allows you within a condition to actually get an estimate of perfusion or blood flow. Well, that was a lot like what I had with a PETO 15. I felt more comfortable making that transition. Only thing is, it turns out, a few years into that technique, that it's also a very, very small signal relative to bold. Just small. It's just little. It's a fraction of a percent of everything that's going on. It's not even 1% of all the signal there is signal of interest. So it's, again, a noise, a signal noise issue, as all of these things are. So with heavy armamentarium and many large guns, we have now analyzed the cocaine data with our fMRI data sets, and we have now nice signatures within nicotine cue-induced craving with Terry Franklin in my lab, opiate cue-induced craving with Daniel Langleben in my lab, and cocaine cue-induced craving with my own work. And within perfusion fMRI, but not without a lot of trials and tribulations in finding ways of optimizing the data analysis. And we have, in the context of those perfusion studies, also begin to overlay pharmacologic probes, right? So I still had not gotten to the point where I could go back to the neuroligand imaging. Raclopride was still not available to me. Anyway, I don't have to put that on the record, but it was not yet available. So we were thinking, well, what if I manipulated the dopamine system with a pharmacologic agent to see if I could blunt the response to the cues in the anatomical situation? And so for our cocaine studies and for our nicotine studies, we've been pre-treating with a GABAergic that seems to show some promise in animal studies. Always, you're about animal studies as I go here, because there's really, for me, always a tremendous interaction with preclinical colleagues and preclinical work as a way of checking what looks promising and also checking hypotheses, you know, so that you go from the clinic back to the animals and from the animals back to the clinic. So that's a theme. And one of the things that had impressed me in 1995 was Dave Roberts' CPDD poster in June of 95 showing that baclofen, a GABA-B agonist that he had tested along with about 600 other kinds of compounds in his well-respected work with progressive ratio work and discrete trials work with cocaine self-administration, looked like it had a very specific signal. It looked like it decreased the animal's interest in cocaine for several hours. Mm-hmm. They could still walk, they could still talk. Well, they weren't talking. But they would lose interest, and it looked specific, and he said, this is the most specific thing I've seen. And I said, it's already available. It doesn't have to go through the FDA. It's been used for humans for 20 years. It modulates the VTA. It reduces dopamine release. Yes, I think we should try this, and let's try that. So we've been doing that, and we've been doing that with the long stuff, and we can talk later if you want, but the very most recent stuff and the stuff I'm presenting at this conference is trying to now go from the longer things that are being written up now and that are going to be this first generation of fMRI studies for us, but to really probe the very shortest end of the temporal continuum. So everything up until the last couple of years has been minutes long. And that was shaped by the technology initially, right? Because you had to have something that you could sustain for for several minutes in order to see a signal. It was also fitting well with our long videos that we developed in the polygraph era. We knew our patients could stay aroused for many minutes. We kind of took that for granted. But as it turns out, mostly to normal stimuli, people habituate. In fact, the very fact that our patients stay aroused so long is, an aside here, wow, that's really funny when you think about it, right? That's actually something that, because I'm right there looking at it, and it's, of course, what it is, and it's never anything but that, and I've worked a lot with patients, and now some with controls, it's a very sustained thing. But then the question becomes, okay, so it's very sustained, but people certainly get into trouble with things less than a 20-minute video. They get into trouble all the time. They even get into trouble when they don't know why they're getting into trouble. They even start to crave when they don't know why they're starting to crave. They even say, I don't know why, I just began to. So I thought, well, here's bold fMRI sitting right under my nose with a bigger signal than perfusion fMRI, easier to work with. Actually comes with, you know, canned or available sequences so that you're not having to work within a developmental context, because perfusion fMRI is still a developmental technique. Mm-hmm. And so we begin
so
to go.
So you're returning, you're going back to bold.
So I'm going to bold where everybody else sort of started. I'm going to it late in the game to exploit its ability to look at very brief stimuli. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when I say very brief, I mean very brief. So the shortest I'd ever gone with perfusion fMRI was 5 minutes. Now I decided to look at half a second.
Wow.
And yes, to look at 33 millisecond cues presented outside awareness. And that's my CPDD talk. So the idea was, we know that these long things can activate the limbic system. We see that the GABAergics can modulate that signal. Wow, I wonder if we can see a signal that looks like that, even at a very brief duration, because our patients certainly seem to get into trouble in the blink of an eye, and they describe that. I don't know. I was fine, and then a minute later, it began, and some of them describe very volcanic, instantaneous craving that's not been working since Wednesday night, but that they were okay 1 minute, the next second they weren't. So, did that. So we have half-second stimuli, neutral drug, sexual aversive, and the 33 millisecond ones that are backward masked. So they're backward masked with neutral stimuli. So you see a, you don't see, you have a 33 millisecond target followed by a 467 millisecond neutral stimulus. Table, hands, cutting out paper dolls, neutral stuff.
And do we process this?
And so what happens is, when I give you a recognition task afterward, you know that you've seen the table, you know that you've seen the hands with the paper dolls. You do not know that you have seen, you do not recognize that you've seen the drug stimuli or the aversive stimuli or the naked ladies. But your brain knows. And so what's really cool, and this is actually, I've got this, I'm working on this down in the casita, writing this up, because I have, it's the, I think it's extremely novel, and it's cool because it makes for continuity of things outside awareness into awareness. So what we've shown is that for the stuff that's outside awareness, as well as a half a second, you see a limbic signature absent the frontal stuff, because it happens too fast for the frontal cortex. It happens before the first synapse, right? This is actually 33 milliseconds is before it can get up to the frontal cortex. You think, well, gee, doesn't that put you in kind of an awkward position if you've got drug cues coming in all the time when you live in a drug-laden environment, and they're coming in all the time, they're coming in all the time, they're coming all the time, and they're coming in under the radar before you can even mount a response or use your tools because they're coming in all the time? Yeah, that would be a problem. So that's what I have, is that basically I can show a limbic signature at 33 milliseconds outside awareness that is amygdala and that is ventral striatum. And not only do we show it, to know if it has any functional significance, you'd like to link it up with something. So we have these great off-magnet tasks that we do the next day that get people's affective bias, again, not asking them anything, but can determine how they truly feel about a picture. How do you do that? Pictures of puppy dogs and flowers will facilitate your rapid identification of a positive noun, like happiness, paradise, joy, those are positive. Negative pictures, scorpions and spiders, will facilitate your rapid correct identification when you see it of a negative noun, like vomit, murder, or death. That gives you the opportunity to throw up pictures in an affect priming task about which the valence is not yet known, right? And you don't even have to say anything to the person. Just throw in your drug picture, and then you ask the musical question, does it facilitate the correct identification of the positive words? Meaning you have a positive affect toward it. Or does it facilitate the correct identification of the negative words? And you can take that bias score, because what it does is subtract the each one of those from a neutral stimulus that's also thrown in, and you can string that up as a score, plop that back into the brain analysis, and you can say, you know, that stuff that's happening at 33 milliseconds, does that predict anything about who feels more positively about the stuff the next day? And if so, where? And it does. So in the ventral striatum and the amygdala, there's a band of activity on the left side, very discreet, and very powerfully predicts who's going to be the positive responders the next day. The more positively you respond the next day in that task, the more the response at 33 milliseconds on day one.
Right.
So this is really pretty cool. This is pretty novel. This is actually, it's one of the really, really, really fun things for me in the last few years, because it helps us make some continuity between things that are outside awareness, inside awareness. Helps us understand, and it will for our patients too, why can things seem to get rolling before they even have a chance to label it? Because they do get rolling before you even have a chance to label it, before it even gets to the point of something that you would label as craving. This is out, and it has potentially motivational significance because it predicts a positive affective response. So it's not just a spot.
Abe Wickler would have loved it because
it's all the way, right?
Unconscious.
Oh, absolutely.
It's an operationalizing of the unconscious.
Yeah. And a vulnerability that you potentially can document, that you can potentially use as a treatment outcome predictor, as a screen for medication. So I've got baclofen in here, and my neuroscience poster, baclofen blocks it. So the poster, that'll be in November, but I submitted it in May. So you pretreat with baclofen and placebo. I just superimposed that on top of this paradigm. To see if it can provide protection against the end coming, right? Because you really need some protection. If you don't have a chance to even mount your responses or put your frontal cortex into place to help out, you better get something that's going to dampen down the system a little bit and kind of bring it into range, or you're going to have what our patients have, is a chronic struggle just to get a foothold. That's the way I view it. So I haven't presented the baclofen stuff yet, but tomorrow I'll present the half-second stuff for the first time. I mean, the 33 millisecond stuff. I presented the half-second stuff at Neurosciences in November. And the 33 millisecond stuff is now, and I'm writing up the 33 millisecond stuff first because it's the most novel. Half-second is cool, but outside awareness goes one step farther and shows that all these things that are conditioning that come directly, you know, from Wickler to 2006, essentially, that mechanism is operative early, and that it potentially could be a vulnerability marker, and that it does not require awareness to be there. End of story. Are we at 3:30?
That's beautiful.
Yes,
so that's a good stopping point.
Yeah. So when can I come visit you?
So this would be fun, right? We just have to figure out a time when you want to get.
Chuck,
it would be good to have me, Chuck, and Tom. Who are you doing?
Tom. Well, in particular,
right.
Those are the ones that I've thought
that you've got.
Are there
lined up? Well, I'm just thinking off the top of who else would it be? Those are the first three people I think about, just because I've known them forever and they've been sort of critical people there the whole time. George Witte's been there a really long time.
Oh, George, too.
He's been doing trials for a really long time. He's doing mostly HIV/AIDS stuff now, but he was really seminal in the early psychotherapy trials and the early early opiate methadone maintenance work. So I would say George would be the other person, probably.
Yeah.
But they're all a lot older than me. Like, Tom's like 4.5 years older than me.
It's not age.
By the way,
experience.
It's funny. Tom was finishing at Bryn Mawr, interestingly enough, when I came. So he ended up there in a funny way too. And you know, and when he went in an applied direction, it was considered to be major defection.
I would imagine.
And people were very concerned when I defected to do a clinical postdoc. That was really of great concern. but I've done enough basic stuff, I think, since to.
Yeah. How's late September?
Late September is okay. You know what I should do? And at this point, I don't have any travel in September that I know of. I have two trips in October because I think neuroscience is early this year, and I agreed to do something in Atlanta in the third week of October. So I...
late September would be before all that.
Yeah, it would be. So I think... And I think September 15th is when Chuck is putting in the big P60 grant. Yeah, so I think that basically between September 15th and October 1st, which isn't an age deadline, but we can find a day to do some talking. And you can fill in gaps. But we did a lot in the hour.
Oh, yeah, so absolutely. No, I think we have a really nice...
broad brush, as Larry would say, the big picture.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.